You're with Richard Glover on ABC Radio Sydney.
If you wrote a book about your dad, what would it be? A comedy? A tragedy? Would the main character be infuriating or lovable? Would they be compelling or crazy? Well, all those various words could be used to describe the larger-than-life father in Mimi Kwa's new memoir, House of Kwa. And Mimi is here on the line from Melbourne. Good afternoon.
Hi, Richard. I'm so thrilled to be chatting to you. You are one of the very first people in the whole wide world to have read my story quite early on. So I'm very grateful that you did that. And I actually can't believe that it's in some people's hands now and they're sort of reading such a personal tale.
Now, as you know, I really loved it. People often say that their dad was a bit odd, but tell me about your dad. You begin this book with the moment that he decided to sue you.
Yes. So my hair went grey overnight. So it was really... it was an incredible sort of Marie Antoinette kind of event where I opened a letter from my dad and it was basically letting me know that he was suing me in the Supreme Court of Western Australia, and the stress that I guess surged through me that night led me to wake up the next morning with a big sprig of grey hair, and I hadn't had any grey hair up until that point. So now I have to dye my hair to cover the grey since then.
Now, he did have form about suing people, which we'll come to, but the subject of him suing you was, as people might imagine, it's all about wills and inheritance, isn't it?
It is. I don't think that there's anybody I know or that you know or that anyone knows who hasn't had some sort of, you know, tension in a family over an estate or over a will. And this was no different with my family, but, you know, quite extreme, I suppose, with my dad taking me to court. So it was over the will of my dad's late sister, my Auntie Teresa, but essentially she'd left me in charge more to alleviate him of having to, you know, jump through the legal hoops and things with probate. And so she thought that she was doing him a favour. But in actual fact, he didn't like that one bit. And I think he just didn't like that idea of a woman or his daughter sort of having that sort of responsibility.
See, I don't know how you'll do this because he's just this larger-than-life figure that bounds out of every page in this book. But see if you can paint a picture of him for us. I don't know which scene to talk about. There's an amazing scene, for instance, where there are bikies in the swimming pool of his motel who he takes on. Try to combine the sort of craziness of the man with parts that you almost admire.
Yeah, okay. Well, to paint a picture, I grew up in the biggest youth hostel in the Southern Hemisphere, and it was called Mandarin Gardens. And so from when I was about 8 years old, I basically had about 100 backpackers sleeping over at my place every night. And so Mandarin Gardens was very well known in the area, Scarborough in Perth, Western Australia, where I lived. And one day, there's an aeroplane going over that I'm sure you and everybody else can hear.
That's fine. We can hear you plenty good. That's fine.
Excellent. So one day, it was a really sweltering hot day in Perth, as it often is in summer, and some bikies were riding past. And, of course, bikies also get a bit hot around the collar, especially in all of their leathers. And so they looked to the left as they were riding down our street, and they saw our big 25-metre swimming pool and thought, oh, we'll cool off. So they proceeded to walk onto the property, and everybody quickly disappeared, all of the backpackers who were around the pool, because they just didn't want to be messing with these people who had just intruded. And my dad came downstairs and very confidently said, "You get off my property." And they picked him up and did, I don't know if you remember from childhood, that sort of milkshake, 1, 2, 3, and swung him back and forth and hurled him into the air. And he landed in the water and came out of the water still talking, saying, "And don't you come back. And, you know, I'll call the police." Anyway, they were sort of laughing. They picked up their guns and their chains and, you know, put on their clothes and got on their bikes and started to ride down the hill. And my dad sort of got his mojo back and ran out onto the street and said, you know, don't come back again. And they started to reverse up the hill, you know, sort of like a bikey ballet, you know, reverse in unison. And my dad just, you know, ran off again. But look, that's just one of the, oh my gosh, you know, I just have a file of stories, you know, filed away in my memory banks of all of these extraordinary times at Mandarin Gardens, the youth hostel, and all of these funny things that my dad did. And even, you know, the catalogue of things that I have, most of the, or a lot of them didn't even make it into the book because there were just so many. But the best ones are in there. And to paint a picture of who my dad is, you know, he's come from, you know, Hong Kong, and the family came from China, and he's actually had an extraordinary life in itself. But like a lot of our elders in any culture that we come from, they don't necessarily, or he doesn't like to really talk about it until I, you know, as a journalist, I like to prize things out of him. And I've definitely done that with this book. But he's just had this extraordinary life, one of 32 brothers and sisters. His father migrated from China to Hong Kong, and that Kwa side of the family, that strand of the family, were among the biggest silk traders in Hong Kong, and they had a shop called Swa Tau Lace. Anyway, my dad grew up in Hong Kong. His formative years were during the Japanese occupation during the Second World War, and that was really fascinating to me in excavating the family history. So to answer your question, to paint a picture of who my dad is, he's just such a character. You know, he's kind of come from these quite affluent, and then after the Japanese basically took the fortune of the family, then very humble beginnings. And, you know, he really, like so many of our, you know, forebears, had to struggle to make a life for himself and migrated to Australia. And I think in that he kind of cultivated a bit of a litigious side to himself, because he was always fighting to survive. And so when it came, you know, to come full circle back to the beginning of our conversation about him suing me in the Supreme Court, I think that was just part of the fight in him. And what I realised in going back through the history of the family and discovering things that, one, that I'd forgotten, and also discovering new things that I just didn't know about the family and about my dad's experiences and his history, it allowed me to understand why, you know, a man would do that to his daughter.
To his own daughter.
And also, yeah.
No, I mean, the book, I suppose, centrally is about the grip that the past has on the present and how difficult the past is to escape. He's a fantastic character. You know, at points you just think this is the most terrible man, you know, the terrible man I've ever met. And at other times you think he's crazy brave. But the other terrific character is the woman whose death and inheritance brings all this legal action. She is the most glorious figure. She's Aunt Teresa. She's to use the term of the time, I'm a BOAC hostess, isn't she?
Yes, Auntie Teresa. So she's really the beacon of light throughout the story for me. As a little girl sort of growing up, I grew up in Perth, but I spent a lot of time in Hong Kong. And so I had this kind of marvellous, you know, dichotomy of experiences between both the Chinese and the Australian culture, and also the English side of the family, which was my mum's side. And my Auntie Teresa just had an extraordinary life, and it was because of her that my dad could afford to come to Australia and study and then, you know, eke out and forge his life here. So my Auntie Teresa was the world's first Chinese air hostess for BOAC, which is now British Airways. And that was just an enormously prestigious position to have in the 1950s. I mean, being an air hostess back then was tantamount to being a Hollywood movie star. You know, it was such a coveted position. And in that role, she would really only crew flights of 15 people. You know, that was the maximum number of people on any aeroplane. It was only the rich and famous and, you know, influential who could afford to fly. And so she met some extraordinary people, and I had a lot of fun, you know, telling some of those stories in the book too.
She's such a glamorous figure. There's something that seems to sum up, I don't know, it's like a Peter Stuyvesant ad or something like that. It's very retro, but she's so fashionable and so gorgeous, and she's moving in such a circle, isn't she?
She is. And there's one sort of section in the book where I explain how she would always explain to me who someone was. And it never quite made sense. She'd say, oh, you know, that's the uncle of the man that owns the, you know, the biscuit company. I think it's Nabisco or something like that. And he married the heiress to the, you know, the watch company fortune. I think it's Seiko. I can't remember, you know, and she would introduce these people to me. And, you know, she'd give me the little behind the scenes briefing before we would meet these people. And I would have no idea who they were, but she'd somehow string together all of these kind of very affluent and influential titles and names and connections. And yeah, she just moved in these extraordinary circles. I don't know how she kept track of everybody, all these, you know, dukes and duchesses and barons and baronesses, but she, yeah, she just had an extraordinary life, and it was very fun to be a little part of it. I was like her little shadow, you know, walking along Repulse Bay Beach in Hong Kong, and she'd be in her bikini and I'd be in my little bikini, and we'd, you know, walk along, and then we'd go across to the tennis club across the road, and you know, and have a club sandwich. And it was, yeah, it was lovely. I had some beautiful memories.
She reminded me of Auntie Mame or something like that from the Patrick Dennis novel. Mimi Kwar is with us. We're talking about her memoir. It's called House of Kwar. It's the sort of book that once you start reading, you just won't be able to put it down. It's a very engrossing story, full of these bigger-than-life characters, partly or mainly, I suppose, Mimi's dad and her uncle and her Auntie Teresa. Auntie Teresa has done well enough so that she's the one who actually pays for your dad to come to Australia in the first place from Hong Kong. You say that he was robbed. I'm always interested in these sort of tiny moments which can determine a life. He's basically, they're going to come out on the ship and they pause at Brisbane and he goes for a shower in the YMCA and someone steals the wallet which contains all the money she's given him for 2 years to get himself educated in Australia. And this tiny moment, you say, changed him forever. The young man who left, the trusting man who left Hong Kong was not the man who arrived in Australia.
Yeah, I really think, you know, much of our experiences on this earth just, you know, life turns on a dime, doesn't it? And just those pivotal sliding door moments really can change who we become. And I think in my dad's case, that had a hugely instrumental effect on what his behaviour would later be, because he was robbed of essentially, you know, much of his beloved sister's life savings. You know, she'd worked so hard to be able to pay for him to come over here to Australia, and for him to lose £1,000, which, you know, in those days was an awful lot of money, and that was meant to last him for 2 years. Like, he was going to live on that money for 2 years. So he had so much pride, understandably. He didn't want to disappoint his sister and say that that had been stolen from him because she'd worked so hard to earn it. So he didn't tell her. And instead, when he travelled down to Geelong, he got a job at a Chinese laundromat delivering laundry for 2 years. And it was only later, after he'd got through those 2 years, that he actually let his sister know. But I think just being robbed by somebody, you know, again, that, you know, brings into question all of the trust that we have for, you know, humanity generally. And it just makes you feel so vulnerable when you have been stolen from. And all of us have probably had that experience to some degree. But for him to sort of have what was meant to be, you know, his, you know, livelihood for 24 months, I mean, that would have just been hugely detrimental for him at the time.
Yeah.
And
so you get this man who is so untrusting of the world, constantly. So he has a 13-year battle with the local council over building regulations. He goes to the High Court of Australia occasionally. Describe that house he ends up living in, that strange house full of all these collected items.
Well, it's so interesting because it's not kleptomania. What is it? Hoarding. Hoarding is now, since I think 2013, is now actually defined as a mental illness or a mental condition, whereas up until that point, it actually didn't have any clinical definition. It was just that, oh, if you're a hoarder, you're a little bit, in inverted commas, eccentric. But my dad is one of those sort of TV documentary series level hoarders, where when you walk into his house, you have to sort of go through a sophisticated sort of latch system with pulleys and wires. And it's quite, you know, if you're not his child like I am, because of course we all get frustrated with our parents' behaviours from time to time, you'd actually find it very entertaining. And I have to say, it is very entertaining trying to just get into his property and shuffle past mattresses and, you know, reclaimed heaters and different things that he's found off the side of the road, and to sort of walk past, you know, pinball machines and gumball machines that have got old socks in them and pens, and, you know, it's just a series of toasters and you name it, he's got it, because just in case we might need it one day.
It so obviously seems to grow out of the experiences he had in those tough early years in Australia. Mimi Kwa is here talking about her memoir, House of Kwa. Of course, we should also talk about your mother, because she was suffering from great and serious mental illness through all this, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was. And I think a lot of the book, which has been a real healing for me to be able to go back and look at my parents' experiences to understand a lot more about what became my experiences and a lot more about myself, a lot of that exploration has been around my mum's mental illness, because when she met my father, she was 19 years old and she was undiagnosed as an acute and chronic schizophrenic. And so she actually went through the majority of her life undiagnosed, but suffering and living with just, you know, extraordinarily difficult symptoms, which of course, for anybody who has a family member or a loved one or a friend, knows that living with somebody with mental illness is very challenging and can be heartbreaking. But the person with the mental illness, I just can't even imagine what she was going through. And I think part of the book is trying to understand that and excavate, you know, what must have been her experience, and trying to see it through, you know, I write about it through a child's eyes because they are my memories of what it was like living with her. But as an adult, it's really helped me to be able to see that she really did the best that she knew how to do.
Well, you know, it's a very loving thing to say, and a difficult thing to say. Right at the end of the book, you quote one of your friends who reads one of the early manuscripts for you, and she says, "Mimi, how did you turn out so normal?" It's not a bad question, is it?
No, and it's interesting because that, to me, I mean, I included that in the acknowledgements or at the end of the book, because that just means so much to me. Because as you know, and I've read your book, Richard, Flesh Wounds, and I just loved it. And it really, I read it at just the right time in my writing journey, where it gave me that little boost to keep going, because
that's good, Mimi, but you win. You know, in the competition, who's got the weirdest parents, you win, which is saying something. I lie defeated.
That's hilarious. Well, look, you really, you know, you filled me with confidence, because I just thought, you know, if you can write about your dysfunction and heal and be public in the way that you have been, then I thought, you know, that just gave me the confidence to keep stepping forward. Because like any writer, I went through, you know, a period of imposter syndrome, because I thought, who on earth would want to read my story? So on that note, and your question about, you know, me kind of in inverted commas turning out so normal despite the dysfunction and despite all of the experience that I've had and the inherited trauma that I've tried to turn around and where I've tried to break the cycle, that, you know, that idea of normality is something that I always strove for. And you may be similar in, you know, having come, you know, from your own experiences, like I just wanted to be normal. And so when my girlfriend turned around and said that to me, I was like, oh my gosh, maybe I am a little bit normal. maybe I have to.
Yeah, I mean, there is nothing like a dysfunctional childhood to give you a great respect for ordinary suburban life, you know, to understand how glorious it is if it can be achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually had a professional position as an ambassador that I had a meeting about a year or so ago, and the you know, the person who was interviewing me said, you know, who's the head of the organisation, he said, you know why, you know, we'd like you to be our ambassador. And I thought to myself, oh, it's because I'm a woman, or it's because I'm Asian, which are all good things, you know, to just, you know, even up the slate a little bit. And I thought, you know, it's about diversity. So I was thinking this in my head, and he looked at me and he said, it's because you're just so normal. And I actually, in that meeting, I burst into tears because I just thought, my goodness, you know, and he didn't know my story. And obviously up until now, nobody did. And this idea that people could perceive me as being a normally functioning human being is just really magnificent for me. I just can't express that enough. And I know that you, you know, you probably have had the same sort of feeling, you know, in your journey.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's right. I sometimes, you know, because I love writing about ordinary humdrum, you know, people might think humdrum family life. And I sometimes go and see those sort of terrible wrist-slashing plays where everything's terrible and the world is awful and it's full of awful, grim characters. And I sit in the front row, you know, in the stalls, and I think, gee, the person who wrote this, they must have had a really happy childhood.
I know, because it's the people who have come through trauma, and trauma is very, you know, it's a very difficult thing to touch. But when you do, and when you heal from it, all you want to do is purvey joy. Mm-hmm. So as you say, the humdrum, the ordinary, just, you know, the bliss of everyday life, the presence that we can have just sitting with a tree, you know, that just brings so much satisfaction. It's actually, you know, it's wonderful to behold. And I guess if you have to go through a bit of trauma, or a lot of trauma in mine and, you know, many people's cases to be able to achieve that, then so be it. And maybe in some ways that's a bit of a blessing.
Mm, Mimi Kwa is here. Her memoir is called House of Kwa. Has your dad read it? What does he think of what you've of the portrait that emerges of him?
Well, there's an element of, and you know, you've read the book, and anybody who reads it will understand, there's an element of sort of survival and also narcissism in my dad's character. So when I told him that I wrote a book, and I really only told him quite recently, because I had been hoping to fly to Perth to show him and to read him some excerpts of the book and to make a big fuss of him. But of course, because of COVID, that couldn't happen. So when I told him over the phone that I'd written a book, he said, oh, well, yes. Well, I wrote a book in 1982. And then he proceeded to send me 15 text messages with photos and other sort of references to the book that he wrote, which was about arbitration, which is a very dry sort of legal topic, in 1982 or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And
because he believes he's a lawyer. He tells everyone he's a lawyer, doesn't he?
Yes, correct. And he did, you know, to his credit, he's a very highly intelligent person, and he did sit in on a lot of legal lectures at university, but I don't think he was really enrolled in the in the degree.
but I mean, you know, as you say, some of the battles go right up to the High Court. Occasionally he wins, though. I mentioned the 13-year-long battle with the local council. In the end, he wins.
I know, he wins. And it's magnificent in itself, in that, you know, this humble, or not so humble, you know, Chinese man who's migrated to Australia, now an Australian citizen, has just managed his way up through the legal system to be able to, as an individual, represent himself in the High Court and in the Supreme Court against, you know, a council, which is a bit of a David and Goliath sort of battle. And after 13 years, he wins. Like, that was just momentous, but for the fact that it was too late, because, you know, after he had lost his property and you know, he kind of had his own financial downfall, that's when the win came through. So it was really too little too late. I'm giving so much away now, but you get the gist. There's so much in there.
And in terms of the battle with his daughter, he didn't win that. The Aunt Teresa, in a sense, won it, didn't she? The arrangements that she'd put in place were the ones that the court decided would stand.
That's right, yeah. So her wishes won through in the end, and I think that's what was most important to me and everybody else in the family involved, was just that her wishes would be honoured. And I think that's what, you know, most everybody wants when they go, is for their wishes to be honoured. And it's just the, you know, it's just all of those people left behind who squabble over it.
Well, you know, it's a very fine book, and it's all full of these astonishing scenes that always hover between tragedy and farce, which is I think a great achievement. Hey, Mimi, congratulations, and thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
There's Mimi Kwa. The book is out this week. It's her memoir of her life, going back really to the great-grandfather in Hong Kong, some very vivid scenes of the horrific scenes of the Japanese occupation of Hong Kong. Then the story, of her dad, one of 32 children. A few people on the text saying, did I hear that right? He can't have been one of 32 children. But, he was. Came here and, the story of him, the glamorous Aunt Teresa, and the battle over the inheritance that separated the whole family.
You're with Richard Glover on ABC Radio Sydney.